I'm Will Chamberlain.
I'm Amber Duke.
I'm Ben Weingarten.
I'm Ino Stepman.
And this is NatCon Squad, where common good and common sense meet. NatCon Squad is produced by the Edmund Burke Foundation, the home for national conservatism. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Okay, so plenty of news today. First, we're going to have Ben, who was at the Supreme Court, discuss yesterday's social media oral arguments. Then Amber is going to talk about the bloodbath kerfluffle. You can almost call it the bloodbath, about what happened with President Trump's comments being taken wildly out of context by media. Then I'm going to talk about the latest updates in the Georgia Trump case and Fannie Willis being allowed to remain as the prosecutor. And finally, Inez is going to speak to something deeply that I feel very deeply, the idea of bringing the universities to heel. So with that, we'll get started with Ben.
Thanks, Will. And yeah, we're recording this Tuesday, so I'm still collecting my thoughts from yesterday when the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the landmark free speech case in the digital era, and really maybe one of the most important First Amendment cases in the history of the Republic that we've long talked about on this podcast, Murthy v. Missouri, formerly Missouri v. Biden. This was also coupled with another case, incidentally, which is interesting, NRA v. Vullo, which is related. Both of these cases deal with and dealt with whether when government leans on private entities to suppress wrong thinkers, this qualifies, certainly in terms of the social media platforms, as a massive First Amendment violation. Similarly, in the NRA v. Vullo case, it was a state regulator pushing insurance companies not to do business with the NRA. So similarly, the government trying to get private third parties to impose, to be weaponized and to target wrong thinkers and to achieve what the government itself couldn't achieve. And that, I've long argued, is very clear in Murthy v. Missouri. A district court had ruled that this was arguably the greatest attack on free speech in the history of the Republic, where, as we've discussed before, a bevy of federal agencies ranging from the FBI and CDC to the Surgeon General's office and CISA, as well as the Biden administration, coerced, cajoled, colluded with social media companies to censor en masse wrong thinkers, first on the Hunter Biden laptop story, then on all manner of things relating to election integrity and outcomes, and then, of course, on all manner of issues relating to the Chinese coronavirus pandemic. And so this case reached the Supreme Court because at two lower levels of the district court and the Fifth Circuit Appeals Court, the plaintiffs prevailed, and they made a compelling argument that what the government did in colluding with and coercing and ultimately partnering with the social media companies to censor core protected political speech did look like a violation of the First Amendment. And the plaintiffs were able to garner a preliminary injunction, a freeze on the speech policing during the pendency of the case. So the Supreme Court heard three different questions yesterday. One was a technical one around the standing of the plaintiffs. And then there were the two other questions about basically, was this a First Amendment violation? And were the terms and breadth of the injunction, the preliminary injunction, freezing the Fed-led speech policing regime proper? And I walked out of the court yesterday, took voluminous notes while observing it. And I do think probably in the audio stream, it probably conveyed to some extent the feeling in the room, but also just a general feeling walking out of the court that our First Amendment rights are hanging by a thread. And I'm not at all confident necessarily that the Supreme Court is going to sustain them. And the main fear about that is, if this censorship regime is not checked at the Supreme Court, then we can expect infinitely more pervasive and sophisticated assaults on free speech to come, and nothing remotely resembling a free and open digital public square. Why do I come to that conclusion? Well, it was clear based on the lines of questioning that the three most leftist justices basically bought the government's line that there was no coercion here, that this was all about a question of coercion, that the government wasn't saying, censor these people or we are going to attack your company, we're going to probe your company, we're going to mess with Section 230, were going to engage in all manner of regulatory actions, that there was not a clear and explicit threat of adverse regulatory or other action that you could tie to the censorship regime that the government helped impose. Now, what the plaintiffs argued persuasively, I think more persuasively in the briefs than during oral arguments, was it isn't about having smoking guns for coercion, although there are plenty of smoking guns for coercion in the 20,000 pages of evidence in this case. Beyond that, it's all about significant encouragement, which is another legal term of art. And the government has one perspective on what significant encouragement means, and the plaintiffs have another perspective on significant encouragement. And the plaintiff's perspective, and I think this is backed by the precedent, is all manner of leaning on private entities to silence people qualify as significant encouragement. The lower courts found this as well. And the government can't do via private entities what it would not be allowed to do itself. I think there was a massive evidence to support that. This is also about abridging. The First Amendment is about abridging of free speech. So in any way, suppressing free speech. You clearly have free speech that was suppressed en masse here. You clearly have the government trying to get wrong think on COVID vaccines or on the security of mail-in ballots suppressed. And it happened. And the social media companies themselves admit that they were constantly coordinating with the federal government about their content moderation policies and then censoring accordingly. The evidence is incredibly overwhelming. And I did not feel that the plaintiffs made a clear and compelling enough case that the government self-evidently was working hand in glove with the platforms to censor. Now, again, the dockets prior to what the Supreme Court took up and the briefs there clearly, I think, make this case. And hopefully the Supreme Court does show some deference to what was found in the district court and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals as well. But ultimately, at the end of the day, what I walked away with was skepticism about how this case is ultimately going to come down, in large part due to the lines of questioning, not from Justices Gorsuch, Alito, or Thomas, who I think are pretty clearly going to come down on the side of this is a censorship regime and there has to be a stop put to it, but just Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Kavanaugh and Barrett, all of them in one way or another seem to show deference to the idea, the government's perspective, that somehow the government is a victim if there's a freeze on its speech policing by communicating with social media companies about what kind of speech to censor. They seem to take a deferential position that the government has a public interest in not only putting out its message, which the government argued, but actually suppressing counter messages. And it wasn't framed that way. And I wish the plaintiffs had done a better job of pushing back on it. Late in one of the exchanges in oral arguments, the plaintiffs did essentially make the argument, the answer for the government when it thinks it has true speech and that there's false speech circulating is to communicate that true speech, not to call on platforms to suppress dissenting views. But I just didn't feel that the plaintiff's case was as clear and compelling in oral arguments as it should have been. And again, the lines of questioning that seem to suggest skepticism and deference to the government having wide breadth to basically tell social media platforms whatever it wants, and that there's this fine line between coercion versus significant encouragement, et cetera. It had a feeling walking out and during the pendency of the arguments that this is a company town, and that all deference is given to the government, and that those three justices in particular might be likely to take a more lenient line and a more favorable line towards the government. And what this would mean, again, at the end of the day, is that the censorship regime would be blessed by the Supreme Court, and it would guarantee infinitely worse to come. So that was my main takeaway walking away from the court. Curious to what you all thought about how the justices might come down and some of the arguments that were put forth yesterday.
I guess I'll go first then. I agree with your assessment of the splits on the court. I guess it doesn't shock me overly much, only because I suspect that the court will be creating and destroying doctrines around this for the next decade. This really is the shape of the censorship regime of the 21st century. And it's something that is new, this relations between the government and corporations, the kind of market power that these corporations have, to what extent they themselves have First Amendment concerns, to what extent the people interacting on those platforms have First Amendment concerns. This is genuinely one of those instances where it's going to take creativity from judges to apply to really like separate sort of what is the end goal in terms of what the First Amendment is actually trying to protect, what rights the First Amendment is trying to protect. This is genuinely a different shape of a beast. I don't expect sort of the first case to go perfectly for us, but I hope that we can build over time on it. One thing to note about this, and Philip Heimberger points this out, how effective and actually strong this censorship regime is, even in comparison to things that the government has been prevented from doing in terms of censorship under the First Amendment in the past. The strongest First Amendment protections apply for against prior restraint, right? So the idea, at least in doctrine in the past, has been our assumption as Americans is that any idea has a right to find its way into the public square. And then maybe in some very narrow cases, the government can come in afterwards and say, no, like you can't. So for example, think the Pentagon Papers case, for example, or some of these First Amendment cases, right? The question wasn't like that. That was a prior restraint case about publishing. Can the government prevent the publication of the Pentagon Papers, clearly like stolen papers, right? Versus can the government come in and prosecute people who leaked those papers after the fact? So clearly the government had to the ability to do that, right? But it couldn't stop people from saying it preemptively. It had to essentially deal with the crime after the fact, after it happened. It couldn't prevent those things from going into the public square. Here, the very structure of the regime is to prevent those views which the government doesn't want circulating from ever entering public discourse. And so it should have the strongest skepticism with regard to government action. So, I mean, I agree with everything that Ben said on the substance. I think I'm just maybe a little more, my posture is a little bit more like, you know, I don't expect the W right away. I do think this is like genuinely a new branch of law, a new branch of doctrine, and it's going to take some time to develop.
I'll refrain from commenting on the legal aspects, and I didn't get to watch much of the case except for that viral Ketanji Brown Jackson clip going around where she basically said that the First Amendment allows the opposite of what it does. It was just bizarre. But I think, you know, from a political perspective and sort of, I guess, a social perspective as well, there is an inherent threat when the government body that's in charge of regulating you comes in asking you to censor speech, even if they're not outright saying, we're going to do this if you don't take down this post. I think the threat is inherently there. I mean, especially when we have Congress now pushing through a divestment bill on TikTok. We've had multiple hearings with leaders from Meta and X and other social media platforms where the government is discussing whether or not to treat these organizations, these businesses as publishers, whether or not to further restrict their ability to sell and share data, whether they want to implement restrictions on minors being able to use the platforms, whether they want to prevent political ads. I mean, they have jurisdiction over so many aspects of social media business that when the government comes in and says, hey, we want you to take down this Hunter Biden laptop story because it's kind of inconvenient for us, any business owner is naturally going to view that as an implicit threat.
Yeah, I was disappointed from what I heard from the hearings. I didn't listen. I haven't like read the whole transcript of the oral argument, but it just seems like they're being way too deferential to the government, the justices are, and way too deferential to the idea that, oh, this is just like lobbying a reporter to change their story. It's not. It's lobbying a platform to censor someone. And the fact that that does not seem to be the core obvious issue here, and that this isn't, you know, overwhelmingly opposed by all the justices is really quite disappointing. With that, we will move to Amber and the bloodbath.
Yes, it was indeed a bloodbath. Or as you called it, I think in the beginning, a bloodbath kerfluffle, which is quite the mouthful. But over the weekend, former President Donald Trump was giving a rally in Ohio for Senate primary candidate Bernie Moreno, who he has endorsed. And during this rally, he started talking about his trade policy and how it surrounds the conversation about the UAW and its president's endorsement of Biden, et cetera. And Trump has been saying from the get-go that the biggest problem with Biden's sort of tacit support of the UAW is that he also supports economic and environmental policies that would destroy the auto industry. Most importantly, perhaps, his push to move the country to solely electric vehicles. So Trump decided to bring this up. He started talking about his trade policy with China and said that if China is, you know, shipping vehicles or vehicle parts to Mexico or Canada, and then expecting that they'll be able to just move those vehicles then across the southern border and sell them in America without facing a tariff, they've lost their mind. That would be something he would address if he were reelected. And he warned that if he wasn't reelected, that it would be a bloodbath, implying, of course, that it would be a bloodbath for the auto industry. And then went on to say that actually that would be the least of the worries. It would be a bloodbath for America, of course, implying that there would be harmful political consequences for other areas of other issue areas if Biden were reelected. So the media decided that they were going to take this comment and isolate it and remove all of the surrounding context about him talking about the auto industry and tariffs and politics more generally, and wrote a whole bunch of articles about how this was basically calling back to fascist leaders. This was akin to Hitler. This was more of Trump's violent rhetoric. He's going to destroy democracy. And even after people started pointing out the context surrounding the clip, you had people like the Washington Post's Aaron Blake, a writer, a different writer at the New York Times, saying, well, even if he was talking about the auto industry in this instance, we just know from Trump in general that he really meant that America was going to face a bloodbath in terms of a bunch of people dying, essentially, like he was going to take office and kill everybody. Obviously insane, but not surprising from the media. They've been doing this with him for years, whether it was the Very Fine People hoax, where they said that he was refusing to condemn neo-Nazis in Charlottesville when he explicitly did so. And the Very Fine People comment was in reference to some of the individuals who were protesting against the removal of the Robert E. Lee statue, which is a perfectly fine position to take. They did it with January 6th, where they accused him of fomenting the violence when he said multiple times for the people to be peaceful at the Capitol after the violence actually started, urged them to return home and go home peacefully. And another very high profile instance of them intentionally warping his words was with his comment referring to MS-13 as animals, which coincidentally was one that he brought up again during the same rally speech that the media then seized on again and accused him of dehumanizing undocumented immigrants when he was talking about the violent El Salvadorian gang whose motto is something like rape, kill, control. So we really have to worry about, you know, dehumanizing them. I think they do it themselves. But nonetheless, I always enjoy these examples where they sort of deliberately cherry pick terms and apply them to more broad targets than Trump was referring to, because they're such an easy example of bias for people to understand. Sometimes I think media bias can be a little bit murkier when we're looking at what stories they choose to cover or choose not to cover, or the framing of headlines. But when you're talking about a situation where the president is referring to a bloodbath for the auto industry if his tariff policy is not implemented, and then the media distorts that to mean that he's speaking like a dictator who's going to slaughter the American people, it's just so black and white, so obvious what they're doing. And it only serves to discredit them. But I'm wondering from the group, as I toss it over, is this the kind of thing that just ultimately backfires on the media? Or is there a legitimate segment of the American populace that only reads the Washington Post, New York Times headline and maybe doesn't actually see the full clip of what he was talking about? I mean, how effective really is this? And is this the kind of thing that prevents independent voters and moderate voters from jumping on board with Trump? Is this the kind of comment that gets taken out of context where people say, well, actually his rhetoric is a little bit too much for me?
In answer to that question, Amber, I think absolutely. There are a lot of people who just read these headlines. And in relation to our previous segment, we were able to circulate the full clip, which in this case is really exonerating, like in a way that some of the more ambiguous or less blatant lies of the media are not immediately exonerated by you can kind of read a clip. For example, the many fine people comment. I mean, I agree that it's not what Trump was saying. And it's pretty clear to me from the clip, but it's his words were hard to parse in that paragraph. And so like there was sort of a case for the way that the hysterical way that the left was interpreting it. In this case, it just isn't. I mean, you hear the full clip of this speech and you immediately know that these outlets have been lying to you with the headlines. Of course, it requires that you actually go watch that clip, but one step worse than that would be if the clip was censored, right? Like the Hunter laptop story, where you can't find the original and all you have to go on are these bloodbath headlines, which again highlights the need to address this 21st century problem of censorship that is a collusion between the government and large corporations and social media platforms. So yeah, I mean, that's really what I thought of when I saw like a lot of people. I feel like this one got debunked fairly quickly. I still think there are probably, you know, a lot of Americans who just read that headline and never followed up with the debunking. And I still think the media has a lot of power, as much as we don't want to admit it on this side of the ledger, because they are so blatant in abusing that power and blatantly lying, like in this case. But I do think anyway that it does matter. But it would matter even more in the kind of regime where this kind of censorship that we talked about last segment is given free rein, because it's very easy to prevent people from following up and seeing the full clip if you just make it unshareable, or you know, only a few diehards are going to be sharing it on Signal or whatever.
Yeah, I think that it's remarkable just yet again how blatantly they lie. Like this isn't even close to accurate portrayal of things. And these same people just at the same time talk about misinformation, disinformation, as though the right is portrayers of it. I mean, this is classic BS. And it just, I think the big takeaway I have is like, these people deserve to lose and have things taken from them and be upset about the world. These reporters, the people trying to push this narrative, they just deserve to have a bad day. And so the way to give them that is to vote for Donald Trump in the fall. And to ensure that Donald Trump is president and that they can just be very, very upset all the time about how their dishonesty has failed. And that's the big takeaway. Like, I mean, we know that the mainstream media and the legacy media is just unbelievably thoroughly dishonest and corrupted. I actually read a very, very interesting article on Tablet all the way back in 2014, which discussed the dishonesty in the context of Gaza and Israel, but it's gotten so, so much worse in the last 10 years, and it's affecting every part of our lives. And man, it makes me irrationally angry to see these people just getting away with this dishonesty. You can't, you know, friends don't let friends vote for Democrats.
The regime media lies because they care about power at the end of the day. They care about their ideology trumping in part because that secures them power. And so this is obviously one more blatant example that proves the point. It's also worth noting, although I don't think this was the intent, by focusing on the distorted comments, the media also is able to skirt the underlying substantive argument that Trump was making, which might be a politically damaging argument, and that is a resonant argument with American people and potentially voters, specifically in swing states, that might really matter. So that's another instance where the dodge by the media is about shielding the left and shielding Joe Biden. Setting aside the kind of media criticism aspect of this, and you know, does this move the voters or not? And I'm not sure at this point if voters who, to the extent there are really undecided voters between Biden and Trump, and I'm always somewhat skeptical of how big that population of people is, hearing for the millionth time that Donald Trump is awful and makes comments that are inflammatory, like I don't know that that moves people. But, you know, certainly it may at least subconsciously impact some. But I would also point out one even more nefarious aspect of this. And granted, I'm at the risk of cherry picking here. This is one individual who latched onto these comments to suggest a policy response. But Juliette Kayyem, who is a CNN national security analyst, don't laugh at that comment, but was a former senior Obama administration Homeland Security official who is, I think, a pretty senior Homeland Security professor at the Belfer School at Harvard. She tweeted out in response to the comments, a proposal. It's good Biden is talking about the threat to our democracy coming from the violence Trump promises. We have a whole department created to address terrorism, and it would be nice to hear a plan about protecting our Homeland Security. DOJ is not built for this. And she goes on to talk about she lays out in a thread that Trump is a menace. That was true in 2020. He didn't stop. I'm proposing a very transparent planning process that engages local and state governments who manage elections. This plan would provide transparency on threats, a crisis response capacity, recommended rules of deployment for public safety resources, a civilian strike type team that can address violence in real time and provide information to the public and media. We cannot be caught flat-footed again. The plan would be transparent and brief to Congress. States and localities cannot handle this on their own. We/DHS plan now so there are no surprises. Trump is telling us what he will do. He is giving us a terror manifesto. The concept of failure of imagination came out of 9/11 lessons. We just couldn't believe that it could happen. It can. Imagine and plan. And then in response to the pushback she got, she says, basically, she's not convinced. To read Trump otherwise would require me to ignore his words and nearly a decade of similar incitement, as if this came out of nowhere. So what that is telling you is that a representative of the national security state is talking about using these comments to weaponize the entirety of the national security apparatus against Trump and all supporters in the run-up to the election. That is how that message should be read. It's one person, but I think it's a powerful and telling comment coming from a powerful and telling person.
All right. Next up is me talking about Fannie Willis. So obviously, if you've been following the news on the case down in Georgia, last Friday, the judge issued his opinion in the disqualification matter. The question was whether, due to a conflict of interest and or perhaps even the appearance of impropriety, Judge McAfee would have to kick Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis off the case, along with her subordinate and boyfriend, Nathan Wade. The judge decided not to do that, instead to basically force Wade himself to resign. The logic here was pretty bizarre. In terms of the factual findings, Judge McAfee bent over backwards to not find that Ms. Willis had lied about when her relationship began with Mr. Wade. There was disinterested testimony from her former landlord, text messages from Mr. Wade's former law partner, and cell phone data that indicated that Mr. Wade had spent the night at Ms. Willis's residence on a repeated basis. And despite that, Judge McAfee brushed that away and decided to buy the clearly self-serving and deceptive testimony of Mr. Wade and Ms. Willis, despite the fact that the judge himself acknowledged that Mr. Wade had already indicated a willingness to conceal this relationship because he had done so in his responses to interrogatories in his divorce proceeding. So not impressive on the finding of facts. Those are probably not going to be disturbed. The judge also had to make a number of errors of law. He did some burden switching where he essentially put the burden on the defendants to prove that even though they had established that Mr. Wade had paid for vacations for the two of them, he put the burden on the defense to disprove Wade and Willis's story that somehow those were reimbursed in cash, despite the fact that they had no receipts and no other corroborating evidence suggesting that they had. That might have been legal error. There's also the fact that the judge conceded that there was an appearance of impropriety and that disqualification can be a remedy to an appearance of impropriety. But that his response to that was, well, we can just get rid of Wade and then the appearance is gone. No, the judge stated that an odor of mendacity infected the case and that there were reasonable questions about whether or not both Willis and Wade were truthful. Those questions don't go away if you kick out just one. Jonathan Turley had a good line where he said that it's like you found two robbers in a bank vault and arrested one. I mean, the problem with the conflict here is that that conflict and the appearance of impropriety remains because Willis has already had a financial stake in the prosecution the entire time it's been going on. And she has also lied now under oath. And remember, what is she trying to prosecute the Trump defendants for? I mean, Jenna Ellis had to plead guilty to, aiding and abetting misleading a Georgia court effectively. Well, what did Fannie Willis just do? She just lied to a Georgia court. Much of these charges involve dishonesty to the tribunal. And so, Willis has, first off, perjury charges. Second, there's a slew of different ethical rules she violated, candor to the tribunal and fairness to the opposing party. But then there's additionally a part of the judge's opinion which I think also could hurt Willis going forward. The judge noted that it was legally improper for her to accuse the Trump defendants of playing the race card for bringing this issue up in the first place. Well, that's a violation of an ethical rule 3.8, which imposes a duty on the prosecutors not to say anything that will heighten public condemnation of the accused if it's not directly related to a law enforcement purpose. Clearly this wasn't. So a massive slew of ethical rules being violated. She should be disbarred. I wrote an article for The Federalist. The ultimate conclusion there was also Brian Kemp and Chris Carr need to get off the sidelines and indict this woman. Chris Carr needs to indict Fannie Willis for perjury. It's very crystal clear she lied under oath. There's a ton of evidence showing that she was in a relationship with Mr. Wade as of 2019, including cell phone tower evidence, which convicts criminals in the state of Georgia every single day. It should be used in this instance, and this farce should no longer be allowed to continue.
I definitely don't think this is the end of things for Fannie Willis. I mean, in addition to everything you just laid out, Will, she's also facing these whistleblower allegations from her office, where she is accused of retaliating against people who raised alarm bells over the office improperly spending federal grant money. And then she also sort of tacitly admitted to campaign finance violations under oath by saying that the cash that she received to reimburse Nathan Wade came from her campaign, which is totally illegal. When you have leftover campaign funds, they either need to go to fund a future campaign or they can be donated to a political party or a charity. You can't just keep them in the rafters of your house to save them for reimbursing your boyfriend for your trips to the Bahamas. So I think that she's got a lot left for people who are taking this seriously to go after her for. And she definitely should not rest easy just because this one judge left her on this case.
So hearing no other arguments, I guess I'll step forward here. 1,000% concur with Will's analysis. The order of mendacity stands over this ruling by the judge, really this entire prosecution. And of course, as we've argued before, I think the justice system in toto with the rampant lawfare against Trump. Let's also not forget there's also recently revelations that this case in large part emanated from an illegally recorded phone call, the infamous Find the Votes phone call that, of course, was tortured and distorted beyond all meaning to try and hang that phone call around the neck of Donald Trump and then create the criminal conspiracy of the century in Fulton County. Again, as I said before, you know, God help any of us if we ever ended up in front of a tribunal in one of these blue districts, because this is the kind of kangaroo court you're going to be subjected to. And the fact that the judge had zero courage of his convictions here, there's obviously a conflict, I think, at least on its face, that he was a former employee of Willis's. He's obviously also in the middle of an election, so that impacts things. We can talk about the fact that other Republican controlled authorities in Georgia, Will alluded to the governor and others, have not stepped up here in this just totally Soviet style show trial of a case where an election challenge again becomes a RICO case. And you have a liar who's leading the prosecution and a corrupt one at that. It just stinks to high heaven. And the fact that it's allowed to persist really shows you that in putatively purple or red states, that the red team, so-called, is so often really the regime team. And that's the takeaway with the fact that you don't have other authorities stepping in. So the question is, McAfee has kind of becrowned himself now with the odor of mendacity that looms over the case that he has now helped contribute to with this splitting the baby kind of decision. And then the question is now, I guess, will other authorities step in and do their job or not? Totally agree. Fannie Willis, she should be disbarred. She should be subject to prosecution. The fact that this is permitted to fester and this poisonous fruit of a poisonous tree case overseen by a corrupt authoritarians, essentially, undermines our justice system to the nth degree. And this was a sad injustice that the judge perpetrated in trying to bring a modicum of justice to this case.
Yeah, I don't have much to add in the interest of time other than to say that the odor of mendacity line comes from Tennessee Williams that the judge was using in Cat in a Hot Tin Roof. But with that, I think I'm going to transition to my segment, which is kind of a bundle of smaller moves, both legislatively and in terms of people publishing sort of op-eds and stuff that indicate to me that there is finally some interest gathering in terms of what is possible to do both legislatively and regulatorily in order to bring universities to heel. So first, there's a bill that was introduced by Representative Greg Murphy of Maryland. This is legislation aimed specifically at medical schools. Now, there have been a series of reports from Ben Shapiro and others in the last both in the last couple of weeks and like in the last 6 to 8 months, if you include some of the things that Aaron Sabarium has been writing about how racial preferences are aggressively being practiced in the nation's medical schools under the banner of DEI. So this is a bill intended to strip all federal funding, including most importantly, that funding that undergirds student loan offers from the government, upon which virtually every university, medical school or no, virtually every university in the country, with a handful of exceptions like Hillsdale and Bob Jones, is completely dependent on for their business model. So this is a suggestion. It's called the Educate Act, and it would strip that funding from any medical school that is practicing DEI and specifically engaging in illegal racial preferences. So I see this as a positive step forward for the Republican Party starting to think proactively about how they can use the law and I'll get to in a minute, the regulatory power to actually enforce some of these statutes in the CRA that are actually very much being flouted. It's just like we know that the Civil Rights Act is being completely ignored by most universities in terms of practicing racial preferences. Of course, it's particularly disturbing when you're talking about selecting doctors, right? The next generation of doctors, and selecting them not for merit or competence or ability, but for the color of their skin. I don't think any sane person wants their surgeon to be in the residency and have a long list of accolades as a surgeon because he or she has the right skin color or sex, rather than because he or she is a good surgeon. So this is a particularly, I think, good place to start, but it highlights how much leverage there actually is over universities. It is purely a matter of political will to go about using it on the part of the Republican Party. Josh Hammer, who was on this program for a long time, and then Max Eden, my friend Max Eden, published an op-ed suggesting that Title VI complaints should be used. So there's a Title VI racial hostile environment claim at Middlebury College right now for Jewish students. They focus on anti-Semitic incidents on campus. These rise to a level of the university actively ignoring or participating in making a hostile environment for Jewish students in an attempt to be woke and inclusive of pro-Hamas groups on campus. That's just one possible avenue. There are a million other ways in which the universities violate Title VI. This is exactly how the left imposes its agenda on universities or on K-12 schools for that matter. Policies like restorative justice in K-12, those are forced through not the Civil Rights Act text, but through regulation from offices like OCR in the Department of Ed. Same thing with the kangaroo courts in Title IX. This is forced through Dear Colleague letters, not even fully regulatory, but just suggestions from the Department of Ed to universities that they have to essentially run kangaroo courts for any accusations of sexual assault under Title IX. Basically, the left has been using this tool for decades to shape universities. It's time the right starts to use those tools as well. I'm hoping that any incoming administration, I'm encouraged by both the legislative suggestions and by the number of conservative commentators who are coming out and saying, no, we need to use this kind of regulatory tool to start to bend these universities to our will. And again, this is not a case where the federal government needs to invent, like that the right needs to create a new power of the government in order to, deal with the ideological problem in the universities. It is already written into our law. And the only reason that Republicans have not done it is a combination of naivete and these kinds of libertarian instincts that are really misguided when it comes to the actual structure of how the university system works. and how much it is interrelated and completely dependent on federal money. Basically, we can attach any strings to those money, that money that we wish to. The only limit to that is in fact our political will, and basically hampering ourselves in this regard. So I think there is enormous, just to end on a kind of up note, I think there's enormous opportunity in this space, but it really requires, all of those usual pieces of Con Inc. to actually get serious about using some of these powers against what are their political enemies. And it's time for the Republican Party to catch up with the base on that, two-thirds of which agrees that universities are doing more harm than good in this country. And with that, I'll throw it out to the three of you.
I actually was giving a speech on Monday to a group of Republican women in Maryland, and one of them asked me something that seems very prescient given everything you just said, Inez, which was, how did the universities get this bad? Were we all just asleep at the wheel? And I just laughed and said, yeah, basically, that is almost exactly what happened. And I love your point as well about the sort of unwillingness of the GOP to use available political power to affect change at the universities, because I think it's a common problem we talk about on this show across the political spectrum in terms of issue areas, right? Like, it's not just the universities where this impulse really hamstrings us, but on so many other issues. And it just strikes me as a common theme of how we find ourselves in so many of these situations as the left completes its long march through the institutions, is that we have diluted ourselves on a conservative or Republican side from doing anything to try to stop it.
Yeah, I mean, I know that there's some different theories on this, the idea that if you use civil rights laws, somehow that would validate or, you know, expand them. But I'm firmly of the belief that you just have to use the tools that are available to you, and that the right needs to be offensive. And I think that can be generally expanded, not just in the context of this particular civil rights law, but of the use of trial lawyers in general. I think there's a historical divide, and the left and trial lawyers have found themselves historically allied with the Democratic Party, because historically the conservatives were the party of major corporations who the trial lawyers were suing. But that's not really true anymore. The corporations have moved far more to the left, and there's no obvious necessary reason why trial lawyers in and of themselves need to be a liberal force in the country. They could also be a force for conservatism, especially if corporate America and major institutions are crazily left-leaning. It opens up the possibility of suing them from the right and making it so it's possible for trial lawyers to make money. But this is something that I feel like we're still going to have real problems with. I remember that, you know, there was a bill that in South Dakota that was going to protect women in sports, and Kristi Noem vetoed it. And one of the reasons she vetoed that bill was she said, oh, it'd be a boon to trial lawyers. It's like, yes, because trial lawyers are going to sue the universities who are mistreating the women who are in their sports programs. Like, if trial lawyers vindicate the rights of our constituents and the people conservatives are looking out for, that's good. And we need to start, I think that the demonization of trial lawyers on our side needs to stop. And I think what, you know, the piece that Josh and Max wrote in City Journal and what Inez is talking about, this is all right. Like, use trial lawyers to achieve conservative ends, in the same way we want to use government power to achieve conservative ends.
Just a brief 30,000 foot comment, which is, it's just striking that, man, if there were a competent Republican Party, imagine what could be achieved. And wouldn't you go through the exercise of, here are the 3 to 5 institutions that make the most significant difference in preserving or restoring our way of life at the federal, state, and local levels. Here are the different tools we have available. Here are the different pools of money we can look to fund these efforts. And we're going to go out and fight them until we win on all of these different grounds. And the left fights on so many different fronts, often using public money, of course, even to fund their, you know, quote unquote, nonprofit and nonpartisan efforts on the outside. But they are so laser focused on dominating every single institution and then using those institutions to drive outcomes, all of which ultimately diminish everything that we believe in and love. And here we're talking about some novel by our standard uses of power in certain realms, and granted, very important realms, particularly the universities. But our side needs to think as strategically as the other side, as ambitiously as the other side, and use every single means available, but also use them strategically given the myriad constraints that we have. And I just think the effort has not been done yet to do that 30,000 foot analysis, but it has to be done or you're guaranteed to lose, essentially.
Right. I'm hosting. On that note, I'll kick it off for final thoughts. And I don't have one right now, so I'll figure one out in a second. So if somebody else wants to go, they can take.
I guess I'll avoid the Mexican standoff that I had with Ben earlier by just jumping in here. I just wanted to make a little cultural note. Over the weekend, Michael Knowles released a very long conversation with Pearl Davis, who I generally ignore, not because I find her ideas shocking, but because she's just not very good in articulating them or deep in articulating them. And I think there are people who articulate the concerns that she raises about family courts, about divorce court, and some of the disadvantages that men have if they go through an ugly divorce in those courts, which I think are all valid points and important. And in some ways, that kind of advocacy or policy talk has been ignored by the sort of the broader right, I think, to our detriment. I think it's a very, it's both true and it is destroying a lot of lives. But the conversation really reinforced for me how, as somebody who has had for a very long time anti-feminist in my bio on Twitter, the current sex war conversations, I think, have lost sight of the goal, which is ultimately the interdependence of men and women in flourishing relationships. And perhaps that's inevitable in a society in which relationships between, not just generally relationships, but especially between men and women are in such disrepair. And so many people are not finding relationships with the opposite sex, whether that's in the context of a romantic relationship or whether it's with even, you know, within families, right? Good relationships, daughters having good relationships with their fathers, or siblings of different sexes having relations with each other, good relationships with each other. You know, so maybe it's not surprising that the sex wars have run so hot as opposed to moving towards that goal. But I really find a lot of these prescriptions extremely counterproductive. The urging men to stay away from marriage, and I know Delano has been on here discussing that as well, urging men to stay away from marriage, urging women to pack a go bag just in case their husband switches on a dime and becomes abusive. This kind of lack of understanding of that any relationship, let alone a marriage, requires trust and vulnerability and reliance on the differences between men and women to actually become two parts of a whole. That goal is becoming lost in essentially a litany of complaints by men about women and complaints from women about men, some of which have validity, some of which don't. But I don't know. I thought that conversation was very enlightening in that way between Michael Knowles and Pearl Davis. And you can really see, like, there isn't a philosophy underneath. There's no worldview, philosophy, no coherent structure. It's just resentment against women. But of course, we know plenty of examples where in much more lauded by the mainstream culture, I would add, of just pure resentment against men for being men. That is not productive in any kind of civilizational building capacity. And it's something that we should fight.
That was a fascinating conversation with Michael Knowles and Pearl Davis. I 100% agree. And I actually recently was looking into divorce statistics to try to counter some of this toxic mindset from the sort of manosphere commentators. And the reality is that there's a lot of things you can do to protect yourself from divorce before getting married. Making a prudent choice in who you select as your mate, being religious, practicing natural family planning, praying with your significant other. Like, there's so many tangible things that you can do that immediately lower your rate of getting divorced, that for most of the people that we're having this conversation with, like the 50% number is not super useful, but I also want to pivot to my final thoughts, which are that our favorite trans influencer, Dylan Mulvaney, has released a new music video celebrating 2 years of being a girl. Of course, we know that's not possible, but alas, this music video continued more of the same of a man basically mocking womanhood and reducing it to pink heels and dresses and wigs and makeup. But this one struck me as even worse than a lot of Dylan Mulvaney's TikTok content. And I wrote about this for the Daily Mail because a sampling of the lyrics is that he says, Monday can't get out of bed, Tuesday morning pick up meds, Wednesday retail therapy, cash or credit, I say yes. Thursday had a walk of shame, didn't even know his name. Friday night, I'll overspend. Saturday, we flirt for drinks. And the reality is that Dylan Mulvaney has a very large following, and it's a very youthful following. And this kind of message that basically women are perpetually depressed, over-medicated, alcoholic, people with shopping addictions is very harmful to young people. This is not the kind of message that anyone should be sending to a vulnerable audience, especially as we have this burgeoning mental health crisis among teen girls and young adult girls, where more are on antidepressants and anti-anxiety meds and say they feel hopeless and lonely. This sort of dive into perpetual victimhood and really, really focusing on the inner self and giving hyper attention to our emotions is the opposite of what anyone would describe as good psychiatric help. And so I just find it fascinating that Dylan Mulvaney started off his TikTok series pretending to be a woman by talking about, you know, being scared of bugs and some of these sort of minor stereotypes to really going full bore into society's characterization of women as these sort of hopelessly depressed and anxiety ridden vessels for pharmaceuticals and other forms of quote unquote self-care.
So I will go in an entirely different direction here and just briefly comment on Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's remarks regarding Israel last week. I would just say straight up that Chuck Schumer is a disgrace, but the remarks are incredibly telling because I think they show, if you didn't already know by the words and more importantly, actions of the Biden administration, that the entirety of the Democrat Party has basically, Democrat establishment has essentially surrendered to the squad, at least on a variety of major issues. This was something that I forecast in my book from a few years ago, American Ingrate, where I argued that Ilhan Omar was the future, if not the present, of the Democrat Party in terms of what she represented and her ideology. Chuck Schumer, in calling for regime change in Israel and calling for a coup against the toppling of a democratically elected leader of an ally in the middle of a war, Benjamin Netanyahu, and doing it under the mantle of I'm Jewish and I speak for American Jews, so this is a kosher position, essentially, was just so disgraceful and shameful on so many levels. Of course, it showed the hypocrisy of the left when it talks about foreign election interference, when it talks about tampering with democracies, trying to impose one's will on others. It's also incredibly strategically damaging for Israel in the middle of a war, but completely consistent with the Biden administration's position. And it shows you that this is the administration that reigns over the Democrats, which is they want to impose essentially a loss on Israel through a ceasefire that turns into ultimately a quote unquote truce that will allow Hamas to survive, that will free up hundreds of jihadists in exchange for whatever remaining hostages may be alive, and ultimately lead to the creation and the unilateral recognition by the U.S. of a Palestinian terror state on its borders, all as part and parcel of an Iran first policy, a policy to make Iran the hegemon in the Middle East, which, of course, requires knocking Israel down any number of pegs because Israel stands as the chief bulwark against Iran as a nuclear powered regional hegemon. So this was a disgraceful episode, not only that, but also in talking about potentially the U.S. having to take action against Netanyahu. I view that as an implicit threat of sanctioning him under an executive order we talked about before The Biden administration says that if you, as an elected leader included, imperil, quote unquote, peace efforts are an obstacle to U.S. policy with respect to the, quote unquote, West Bank, i.e. Judea and Samaria, then you can be sanctioned. That would apply to Benjamin Netanyahu. And so I think this was a veiled threat to potentially sanction him. What a disgrace. What a disastrous episode for Israel strategically that's going to undermine the U.S. strategically, because Israel and the Sunni Arab nations there were forming a bulwark against Iran. That's all been destabilized now, thanks to the Biden administration's Iran first policy. And then one other exit takeaway is, who would want to be a U.S. ally having seen what the administration has done to Israel? Who would ever, wouldn't it be safer to be an adversary or potential adversary or neutral than an ally when you see what the U.S. does when it has leverage over you? So just a disastrous episode all around. And this is the Democrat Party that represents 50% of America. Mercifully, neither Americans nor Israelis overwhelmingly agree with Schumer's policies, positions, and Biden's policy positions. In fact, they reject them. But nevertheless, the consequences are far ranging. And I think this breach between Democrats and Israel, long time coming and long clear, couldn't be any more stark now. And that'll be one of the things that for some, I think, is on the ballot in 2024.
So I'd like to point out, or sorry, my final thought is that Peter Navarro is going to jail. Very sadly, it looks like he was convicted of contempt of Congress and has exhausted his appeal. So he'll be spending some time in federal jail. It's remarkable that the Democrats decided to go as hard on this as they have. I don't think anybody had been convicted of contempt of Congress for about 40 years. As a result, it's just one of these, another example of the government being weaponized against conservatives. And I worry that when conservatives take back power, we won't be as aggressive. There needs to be, you can't unilaterally disarm it when it comes to this stuff. So the next time a Democrat decides to defy a congressional subpoena, if we find that Hunter Biden did defy some congressional subpoenas during this Congress, well, he needs to be in prison for it. We are not the people who play soft when y'all play hardball. That cannot be the way it works. And Republicans need to do that. Okay, well, that is going to wrap it up for today. On behalf of Amber, Inez, and Ben, thanks for tuning in. I'm Will Chamberlain. See you at the next NatCon Squad.